ready or not.
Another here hits jam from WAPLOADED.com.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's ASF Weekly Science Podcast. This is Alicia Halliday, and it's March 23rd, 2020. The opening music has changed, as you can tell, because ready or not, here comes telehealth. The coronavirus panic still has everyone hiding indoors, which has enormous implications for families affected by ASD. Of course, this is for good reason. I do want to point out that ASF has listed different resources for families, caregivers, and people that are interested on how to handle child's autistic behavior after they've been cooped up in the house for several weeks is on the ASF homepage. There's also links to new Medicaid policies to enhance coverage, some video-based coaching tools, and information on your rights under IDEA. Again, it's right off the homepage under resources, so please check it out if you need it. We're going to be adding to it, modifying it, probably reorganizing it, but we want to be responsive to what's out there. And of course, we're also vetting it. No Jim Baker posts about drinking bleach to help cure coronaviruses. Okay, but now on to this week. So last week's podcast was on anxiety, and I wanted to take an additional week to address a topic that's on the minds of everyone who has any sort of medical or behavioral health appointment recently: telehealth and telemedicine. Now, this has really taken off in the last couple weeks. Everything from psychological therapy appointments, including my own, and also pediatrician regular check-ins are now being done remotely. This is for two reasons. Number one, healthy people should stay away from sick people. And two, we need to keep doctors and nurses healthy so they can keep us healthy during this epidemic. So it's to limit person-to-person contact. So when your appointment changed to telehealth, smile and please don't complain. They could have canceled your appointment. There are two words that I just mentioned, telehealth and telemedicine. What's the difference, or is there a difference? Well, yeah, there is. So telemedicine is the practice of medicine using technology to deliver care at a distance. A physician in one location uses some sort of telecommunications infrastructure like FaceTime or Skype to deliver care to a patient at a distant site. They likely do this for a consultation and a follow-up with a prescription or a referral for another physician. On the other hand, telehealth refers broadly to electronic and communicative technologies and services used to provide care and services at a distance. This is more like what we're doing now. So what's the difference? Well, telehealth is different from telemedicine in that it refers to a broader scope of remote healthcare services than telemedicine. Telemedicine refers specifically to remote clinical visits, while telehealth can refer to remote non-clinical services. I'm going to lump it today into telehealth. I know that that's not scientifically correct, but we're going to call it telehealth for the purposes of this podcast. Now, I got this previous information from the American Academy of Family Physicians, who actually supports the expanded use of telemedicine and telehealth as an important and efficient means of improving the health and welfare of their patients. It has to be, of course, conducted within the context of appropriate standards of care. Well, it's certainly being expanded now, ready or not, and whether it's being used in the context of appropriate standards of care, well, that still has yet to be seen. So what could telehealth be used for? I actually don't think we know all the potential uses yet. So far, it's been used to address the lack of highly qualified professionals in the community. So this can be training people to deliver interventions and making sure that they feel supported and have sufficient opportunities for expert interaction. In other words, training and supervision. Or it could actually be delivering an intervention. That's telemedicine. This could be because of geographical location. It could be because parents of young children need support in their home. Or it could be the amount of traditional clinic time just isn't available or enough. Telehealth is a way to support additional hours. This could happen in places where there is no healthcare, like the middle of Alaska. It might be used by itself because nothing else is available. Think not just Alaska, but the middle of Africa. But for autism, the best case scenario for kids is that it's used in addition to enhance clinic-based interventions or to help coach parents on delivering interventions in their home. That's really how it's been used so far in scientific studies. Originally conceived, I guess you can tell, it was meant to enhance, not replace, a face-to-face version with a clinician. But I can tell you all bets are off now. I think we can expect to see more studies that look at the exclusivity of telehealth. The good news is that there have been some studies looking mostly at the feasibility of, but sometimes the efficacy of, telehealth on outcomes in kids with autism. In fact, a systematic review published a few years ago focused on the efforts of using telehealth to provide behavioral-based provisions to individuals with a diagnosis of ASD. It's usually ABA-based. It doesn't mean strict ABA. It means things based on the principles of ABA. They include environmental modification to teach new behaviors. These things are based on principles of learning, that there are things that can make behavior or learning more probable or less probable. These include interventions like the Early Start Denver model or something about joint attention, which I'll talk to you about later on in the podcast, and early interventions where parents need training and support, because who sends an infant to 40 hours a week of clinical intervention? They are mostly done at home. If you have questions about ABA in general, Molly Riley, an expert in the topic, wrote a blog on the ASF blog site a couple weeks ago. So what does this mean, telehealth for intervention? Well, it's not one thing, it's multiple things. Again, it could be telehealth for intervention where people are coached, or it could be direct intervention over the computer through a video connection, and that's more telemedicine. So these things include written instructions, websites, including interactive modules, training DVDs, manuals with video-based conferencing and didactic training. Equipment needed are laptops, cameras, scanners, and commercially available video conferencing software like Zoom. Jeez, I wish I invested in Zoom before this all happened, by the way. A hybrid approach is usually used, to be honest. Now, as you can imagine, there was a lot to review in this systematic review. Once the investigators whittled down the inclusion and exclusion criteria to ensure that, in fact, they had data, it ended up with 28 studies. The bottom line is very few of them were really good. It doesn't mean they were all bad. It just means they could have improved. Now, that's not necessarily the fault of the researcher. Sometimes when it comes to telehealth, what you get, and you try your best knowing that the gold standard randomized design is not possible. Previous to all this, you couldn't possibly ethically deprive someone of in-person services, so you add on rather than take away in these telehealth models. Now, again, all bets are off. Some people are getting just telehealth if they're getting telehealth and nothing else. I came across a study in Alaska on telepsychiatry in rural Alaska where there was literally nothing. And telehealth really didn't provide any additional improvements. In fact, sometimes telepsychiatry recipients were worse off than those that got nothing. Now, this is the sort of environment where you can do a randomized trial. That Alaska study was looking at substance abuse, and substance abuse is a complex issue. I tell you that because no telehealth program is just like another, and we really don't need just telehealth. We need a combination of things. So just because something didn't work for substance abuse in rural Alaska doesn't mean something's not going to work for autism behaviors in another area. But now we're in a new situation. People are getting zero, or they're getting telehealth, or they're getting some in between. We need to be mindful that this is an opportunity to, in fact, do a randomized clinical trial or actually just look at telehealth versus getting nothing at all. Other problems that with these studies that maybe made them less than ideal, or sometimes baseline characteristics were not included, like age or gender. There weren't that many people enrolled in the studies, so low sample size was also an issue. And sometimes, because they were small, there was really some question about whether or not they were effective or whether that was hard to get from the study. The good news, though, from the review is that telehealth is an acceptable platform for behavioral interventions and assessments. In total, out of the 28 studies, 293 interventionists were trained. This is a huge thing. This is great. And it provided intervention to 307 individuals with ASD. So again, this is good. It's providing something from the community. Now, outcomes indicated positive gains across participants in all of the studies, and that's in at least one outcome. About 61% of the studies reported something improving across other or more than one outcomes. Now, what were these outcomes? They can be the outcome of the interventionist or the child. It can be problem behaviors like self-injury, screaming, non-compliance, or they can be things like social communication or imitation. They can also be the feasibility and acceptability of the parent or person who's receiving the intervention in how they perceived the telehealth experience. So it isn't just about the outcomes, it's about whether or not it was an acceptable form of intervention. So there's more studies coming up that are addressing the use of telehealth for children with rare genetic disorders. And this is because the number of people with that disorder in one place may be low, so the expertise in that place may be limited. Take, for example, something called tuberous sclerosis. Tuberous sclerosis complex, or TSC, is a rare genetic disorder which occurs in about 1 to 7,000 children. About 60% of kids with TSC also have ASD, so this is relevant to ASD. Now, because it's also diagnosed or it can be diagnosed in utero, really early interventions for infants are really needed, and they can be monitored for signs of atypical development well before a clinical diagnosis is made. This makes early intervention a need, not a want, as soon as possible. However, many parents of these kids can't afford to move, fly, or go to distant locations to receive intervention services. So in order to address that challenge, one study at UCLA offered a telehealth option for early intervention. I'm explaining this to you because I want to explain to you how telehealth normally works in terms of intervention. So this is more a combination of telehealth and telemedicine. So caregivers first attended an in-clinic intervention session focused on active coaching, live demonstration, and direct feedback. The intervention was based on joint attention, symbolic play, and engagement and regulation. It was called JASPER. And really, this is a brainchild of Connie Cassery at UCLA and Shefali Jesse at UCLA. All of these things, joint attention, symbolic play, engagement, and regulations, are early precursors to social communication skills later on in life and are targets in infants. Okay, so then after this initial in-person session, everyone got a tablet to use during the study, along with a video demonstration and instructions on how to use it. The goal was to go home and practice the strategies daily. The caregivers got text messages to remind them and also to remind them how to record how much time they were spending on the intervention. Once a week, they were asked to upload a 30-minute video of them delivering the intervention, which was reviewed by a trained interventionist who then provided feedback during an hour video conference with the parent. Again, you're hearing more about telemedicine than telehealth. Then the new content was introduced to advance skills if appropriate. So far, most of what they were looking at was feasibility and acceptability, and it was did great. And not for nothing, the studies also showed promising results in the areas of parental stress and competence, which is a really good thing. There's also a literature around telehealth and telemedicine in people without autism, and I know many of you are just as interested in that. It ranges from psychiatric crises that result in ER visits, which don't seem to work that well, to PTSD in veterans, which does seem to work pretty well, to substance abuse, where the results are mixed, right? Substance abuse is a pretty complex issue, and remote interventions or even remote consultations may not be enough. The story with substance abuse is complicated, and you should know that there are factors in addition to a physician or even an AA partner that contribute to relapse. And just like everything, any telehealth program is only as good as the program itself and the people delivering it. So I have to tell you, we're in early days of this. And so a lot of what you may be receiving now is a video, 20 minutes on a video asking you how you're feeling and how you're doing and asking if the physician can do anything for you and providing resources that you can find on the web and checking back in with you the next week. I don't think things like dentist appointments are going to be able to be done by telehealth or telemedicine. Now, one limitation of telehealth, as we're seeing today, is that it's dependent on hardware. You need a smartphone, an iPad, or a computer with a camera. A lot of people, but not everybody, has that, especially the internet connection. And also, not every parent or caregiver has the same ability to implement interventions in the home that a clinician would in the clinic. A measure of fidelity has normally been included in some of these telehealth and telemedicine approaches, but it's really how well the person on the other end of the video was showing that they were doing that they were supposed to be doing. It isn't a camera set up to monitor every single action and every single encounter during every single training session, and it's not going to monitor you 24/7. No one's going to be looking at you. Nobody's going to be able to be drawing blood. No one's going to be able to be really working with you the same way that they would if they had face-to-face interactions with you. It's not the show Big Brother. And even if fidelity is high in some of these studies, sometimes it wasn't 100%, which means there's always room for improvement. We're really in an area that's somewhat unknown, but a lot of these telehealth coaching approaches have been shown to be really effective, and these resources are being shared on the internet. You should check that ASF webpage out. Another area that it's being used is in the bottleneck of diagnosis for ASD. Now, this is tricky. A number of companies are using video-based assessments to consider whether or not it's the same as a clinic-based evaluation in terms of getting the diagnosis of autism right. So far, it's not. There's a lot that goes on in a video-based diagnosis that's not possible so far. You really can't seem to diagnose based on a 30-minute evaluation over a video conference yet. Maybe with better biomarkers, that will be possible to combine video evaluations with biological measures, or maybe multiple 30-minute evaluations using some sort of psychometric or video-based modeling program. But we're not there yet. However, video-based diagnostic consultation in conjunction with early intervention referrals has been helpful to increase referrals for those diagnostic evaluations. It seems to empower primary care physicians to make a referral and have a kind of discussion with parents about their concerns with greater confidence. So that's a benefit, even if it can't be directly used to make a diagnosis. Now, given all these things, though, especially with this current situation, telehealth is probably here to stay. If you're on Medicaid, telehealth appointments are reimbursable to your physician. So they may or may not want to continue some sort of telehealth after this whole thing is over. We need to learn now to use it to make it better, because it's clear that despite what goes on with the coronavirus, we're going to be forced to access it now and in the future. It's not perfect, but neither is healthcare in general. We need more ways to improve telehealth, and right now we're kind of building the airplane as we fly it, so to speak. I know that sounds kind of scary, but it's kind of true. We're going in the right direction, but we still have a long way to go. Good studies are few and far between and are still trying to perfect the process. Unfortunately, we have been dumped into this pool with little warning with the situation we're all in. But telehealth really is a good option, and especially because we want to stay out of places where people are getting sick. Be thankful it's an option. I hope this was helpful, even if it was a little bit sobering. I don't want you to cancel your telehealth opportunity. I want you to take it. And I want you to make note of whether or not you think it's helpful or not, or how it can be improved, because we are going to come out of this. And when we're going to come out of this, telehealth is going to need your feedback and your help. Thanks for listening. Stay healthy, and please check out the ASF website with multiple resources, including some telecoaching. Thanks for listening, especially at this particularly difficult time.
Ready or not, another hits jam from WAPLOADED.com. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and make you one.